We,
Sonia,
and Janooni are a couple of pals studying science in undergrad. We are not professionals.
Though every episode is meticulously researched, mistakes do happen.
If you notice that anything,
and we mean anything,
we state is inaccurate, please let us know.
Your comments, suggestions, and queries are important in furthering our personal and audience's understanding of science.
Thanks for being a part of this discussion.
We appreciate you.
We really do.
Bop, bop. Beep-a-da-bop.
Welcome back to Beaker Bros.
Beaker Bros, the podcast where Janooni and I, Sonia over here, talk about things in science.
And research.
And research. I only have my beaker
today. Oh, it's fine. Anyways, today's episode.
Yeah, today's episode is something that Janooni and I are both very passionate about.
I like how you say that for every single episode.
Well, if I ever started off saying, you know what, we don't care about this topic, but we're talking about it anyways.
Imagine. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. For this very interesting episode of Beaker Bros, we will be talking about health inequity and disparities in health.
Yeah.
That is a bit of a mouthful. We've said this word, or this phrase, or this term, health inequity, and health equity quite a bit. So I thought, you know, why don't we preface it specifically? You know, what does that mean to experience health inequity?
Yeah.
Well, according to the World Health Organization, the WHO for short,
ooh,
health inequity is basically a phenomenon that describes the unfair and avoidable differences in health status seen within and between countries. In countries at all levels of income, health and illness follow a social gradient. The lower the socioeconomic position, the worse the health. So, to begin, that's a bit of a mouthful, but that's basically saying that around the world, from the many global health articles and publications and reports that have been done, we've seen that people that come from a lower socioeconomic background, so have lower income status, come from disadvantaged system areas and regions based on the color of their skin or treated unfairly or whatever, like that group of people is prone to experiencing lower health-related quality of life because of unfair and avoidable differences in health status and health treatment.
Yeah, it might not be as visible. There's like cases where, like, of course, like areas that are not as fortunate to have a certain level of healthcare, it might not be as visible as that. It could be things as small as in our own setting, in our own access to healthcare. It could be something as skin color that doesn't allow for the same level of quality of healthcare for all individuals.
So true, because of biases that we have or a lack of research, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So like one article that looked at, it was basically looking at the absence of images of skin of color in publications of COVID-19 skin manifestations. And that's literally the title of the article, and it's by Lester et al. It basically exposes the lack of health-related publications pertaining to patients with, like, darker skin tones.
Mm-hmm.
And then from this article, the results basically indicated that COVID-19 skin-related cases, so they only looked at COVID-19, were predominantly of patients with lighter skin. So there's this issue where all these articles were reporting, yeah, these are the symptoms, this is what it looks like, but it's all reporting only lighter skin.
Yeah.
And this is only an issue because we know that skin disease can present differently in colored skin, and the shortage of research can actually result in delayed diagnosis and consequently poor health outcomes.
That's astonishing. COVID-19 presents differently based on the color or, like, your racial background in some individuals. Like, its effects on your skin and stuff like that.
No, definitely. It's also like the whole idea that this darker skin tones have not really been studied for the symptoms that well. So like when medical students are learning about this is what it looks like, this is here, these are the symptoms, or doctors are doing it, they're not able to diagnose it as fast as if someone came in with lighter skin tone, right? And it's just the fact that there is a bias that not many people are aware of. Mm-hmm. And that something needs to be done because, well, people that are colored skin tones are not receiving the same care.
Yeah.
And that just sucks. Even if it's in a place where all the quality of healthcare is great, like where we are, and we're still getting, like, we're getting doctors being like, there's no shortage or whatever, everything's good, right? Like, we have the drugs, drugs. We have the meds.
The drugs.
We have the meds. We have the staff. We have the nurses. We have everyone, right? We have the support systems. But it's literally what the healthcare professionals have learned, and they're not able to do it because they haven't really learned that.
Yeah, just to add on to that, from our last week's episode where we talked about or spoke about gender biases as well, gender biases are so prevalent in the context of health and how we study health and health outcomes in men and women very greatly, but it's often very underreported. So, for example, have you ever seen shows where... What's an example? Where, let's say this dude, he has a they have a heart attack, right? And they clench their chest and their heart and they fall to the ground and they look like they're in debilitating pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that doesn't necessarily happen in women as frequently. They don't experience that, like, the heart-clenching feeling when they fall to the ground when they experience a heart attack.
That's true,
For women, heart attack symptoms often present as jaw pain or... like shoulder pain, not something that's like entirely debilitating, but it still presents in that sort of way. And the way that like health conditions and health outcomes are seen in the media as reported by different TV shows and then different forms of media in general,
like books or whatever.
It varies tremendously, but it's predominantly reporting health outcomes that men experience.
That's true. No, that's fairly true.
And to give them some credibility, though, it's not entirely their fault, especially during the 70s, 80s, 60s.
Yeah.
Pretty much most of our medical history knowledge has been studied in white men.
That's true. I've even read something about how, like, women, they can experience heart attacks for, like, a couple of days and not even know about it. Like, they just go and just say they have some kind of pain. But when they go to the hospital, then, like, the doctors or the nurses or whatever, then they realize, wow, you're having a heart attack. But they didn't realize that just because they're, like, it's not the same symptoms as it would present if they were male.
Yeah. And I think that's a shift that's starting to become more prevalent now.
Oh, yeah.
Where health practitioners, nurses, doctors, whoever, are starting to, and researchers as well, are starting to engage in research that's more holistic and incorporates perspectives from not just different sexes and different genders, but also different ethnicities and racial backgrounds.
Definitely. No, yeah. Mentioning about racial disparities in health, there's actually a report called the Heckler Report, which is like a big report that the U.S. government actually did in efforts to investigate the health inequality amongst racial and ethnic groups. So the report actually, I'm just picking up a few information, but this report actually emphasized the fact that six medical conditions between blacks and whites accounted for 86% of excess black mortality. And excess deaths they're defined as the difference between the observed number of deaths in specific time periods and expected number of deaths in the same time periods. Basically, they're saying that the number of deaths they expect is surpassing that.
Okay.
So, and these six medical conditions are accounting for these excess deaths in black individuals.
So what are they?
Thank you, Sonia, for asking that question.
You're welcome.
So the six conditions are cancer, heart disease and stroke, diabetes, infant mortality, homicide and accidents, right? So actually a big part of it, 26.9%, is for infant mortality, which is kind of sad.
So I guess to summarize, to see if my understanding's correct.
Yeah.
Are you saying that... people of, like, different, or what am I trying to get? Are you trying to say that, like, black people experience these conditions at a predominantly higher rate than those of different backgrounds, racial backgrounds? Or are you saying that, like, it's above a certain threshold?
It's above, like, okay, there's an expected number, right?
Right.
For, let's say, black individuals and white individuals, because we do know that diseases are more predominant.
Genetic differences and stuff like that, yeah.
So with that, so they have that, like, expected number, but these six medical conditions are actually surpassing that number, which is saying there's more deaths than what should be.
Okay.
And it's basically saying that 45% of the deaths up to the age of 70 years in Black population could be avoidable if better evaluation, detection, and treatment had been available. So it's not even like a fact of like it because of genetics. It's no, there's this 86% could be avoided.
That's so interesting. That brings up the topic of modifiable factors in health.
Mm-hmm.
So in health, when assessing health outcomes and health, just health in general,
mm-hmm.
There are these things called modifiable risk factors mm-hmm. and non-modifiable risk factors.
Okay.
So non-modifiable risk factors are those such as stuff that you're born with and you can't necessarily change about you.
Mm-hmm.
So like your inherent genetic makeup,
mm-hmm.
even though it can be influenced by environmental factors and stuff like that, predominantly your genetic makeup and your predisposition to certain genetic conditions are more or less set, like, based on your genetic code that you're born with.
Yeah.
That would be an example of a non-modifiable factor.
Yeah.
A modifiable factor
mm-hmm.
would be something like obesity, physical activity,
mm-hmm. smoking history.
Yeah, I'm just trying to like think
no, it's fine.
In my head. And in the context of like a lot of health conditions, the first one coming to my head is stroke.
Mm-hmm.
90% of strokes can be prevented by modifiable risk factors.
Oh, wow.
90% of strokes. So
damn.
The fact that you're saying these, like, this is just in the context of stroke. The fact that you're saying that there's so many modifiable risk factors mm-hmm. that can not only prevent stroke, but so many other health outcomes,
yeah.
that just highlights how prevalent these like disparities are in health.
Yeah. It's messed up.
it's overwhelming. Like, sometimes for me personally, whenever I hear these numbers, like 90%, 35.42%, 5%, whatever, like random numbers. It's hard to contextualize.
No, yeah. It's like, think of it, in a room of 10 of your friends, mm-hmm. 9 of those, like, everyone dies eventually.
Yeah. It's life. Yeah.
But 9 of those deaths could have been avoided, or their life could have been prolonged.
Yeah, specifically with stroke.
Yeah.
But simply by addressing these modifiable factors. And a lot of these modifiable factors can be addressed mm-hmm. by addressing health inequities.
Yeah.
That are predominantly faced by those of different socioeconomic backgrounds, etc.
Doing more research into this so other health professionals know what to do when there's different,
mm-hmm.
Racial groups or ethnic groups coming, or even recognizing different areas that need better, like, access to healthcare.
Yeah. And that's why I personally find research so exciting. And especially as like new generations of researchers are coming in, they're starting to recognize that these are pre-existing gaps
mm-hmm.
that we have in existing literature.
That's true.
And as incoming researchers and doctors and scientists and healthcare professionals, it's our responsibility to improve upon what we know.
Yeah, there's always going to be gaps, but...
Yeah, there's always going to be gaps, but it's important to take proactive steps in mm-hmm. mitigating these gaps.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to tie in, though, we were just talking about those socioeconomic differences that could be addressed.
Yeah.
There's an article that I came across a couple years ago, actually,
mm-hmm.
back in 2019, and it really solidified my personal interest in the topic of global health and health inequities.
Yeah.
So specifically, but it really relates to this conversation that we're having. So this article in particular was released by Columbia University's School of Public Health. And the title of this article is "It Genetic Code or Postal Code That Influences a Child's Life Chances." So it's basically, this whole article looked at, like, whether your postal code, like, where you live, is an indicator of how your health-related quality of life and your quality of life will be throughout your lifespan.
That makes sense.
And they found, this is specifically in the United States, but as we'll soon address, it's also applicable to Canada as well in Hamilton, where we reside. But basically, it's very clear... A very clear consensus found that if you are from a socioeconomic background that is disadvantaged, if you live in an impoverished community, if you are someone a part of the BIPOC community, all these factors that shouldn't necessarily be influential in determining your health, but based on like systemic racism in healthcare, if you are from those two or three predominant communities, your quality of life and your chance at life is significantly impaired simply because of where you live and the color of your skin. So even though we're sitting here right now as two women who are part of the BIPOC community, we speak from an unbelievable privilege when we say that we're fortunate to have the level of health that we do.
Yeah.
Knowing that a lot of people from our community don't experience the same privileges that we have.
That's definitely true, yeah.
For me, when I first read this article a little while ago, and when it came up in my courses and stuff like that, I found it, like, overwhelming.
No, definitely.
To hear, like, again, this is some, like, it's common knowledge, and for the most part, a lot of people agree on this, so this is me just rambling. But the fact that a child's opportunity at life is impacted simply because of where they live and the color of their skin, like, that is the very definition of not just health inequity, but
inequity. Yeah.
In every sense.
Definitely.
And it's so, yeah, for me, it's just overwhelming to hear that. But again, as people that want to pursue healthcare, I feel like it is our responsibility to address these disparities as we continue on in our education.
Definitely, and also, like, raising awareness that there are disparities, right? And that solutions need to be done. Solutions need to be made.
Yeah. Like, at this point, there's so much literature out there discussing health inequity. So it's not something that's unknown. What we're saying are statistics that aren't, like, unheard of.
Yeah.
Now it's a matter of, okay, we have the past two decades of literature saying that these are the health disparities that people are experiencing. Now it's a matter of, how do we address them?
Yeah.
Then this is something that policymakers and scientists have to work together, and the general public as well, with community engagement and stuff like that, and participation, in order to address. Yeah, just to bring the conversation, though, back to our own home, and, you know, as, like we said, we're two Canadian gals currently residing in Hamilton. We often talk about health inequity being something that's predominantly faced by, or disparities in health in general, predominantly faced by people from, like, third world countries, quote unquote, like developing countries. But in reality, disparities in health and health inequity is something that is commonly experienced in our own backyard.
That's actually really true. Like, it reminds me, so when I was younger, we didn't live in the best part of Scarborough.
Yeah.
Right? And if we wanted to go to, like, the doctor or something, we would have to, like, we drove, like, an hour or something just for, like, a doctor. Like, just for, like, a checkup or something. Like, if we were sick or something, or, like, it's just something, like, not even that intense, right? We would have to drive an hour just to find a doctor that would help us and give us, like, the meds that we need and all that stuff. But now that I look, like, filled with resources, there's a walk-in clinic, like, literally 5 minutes, like, in 5 minutes in every single direction. Which just shows you, like, even, like, it's not a matter of a whole 2 hour, 3 hour difference. Like, it's a 20-minute drive, and there's a difference in healthcare.
Truly. Just on the conversation of that, going back to stroke, I read an article recently where, okay, so with the whole topic of stroke, receiving rehabilitation services, regardless of, like, the capacity that they are, like, any form of, like, constructive rehab is so important in order to improve health-related quality of life for stroke patients. And not just for stroke, but just, like, any sort of negative health event that occurs in your life, any form of rehab is more effective than not receiving rehab.
So
there was an article that looked at stroke, the ability of people from rural communities in Ontario, and looked at their ability to access stroke rehab services. And a rural community in the context of this article was defined as a community of less than 10,000. But in Ontario, communities of less than 10,000, like, there's a million people in Ontario that reside in communities that have less than 10,000 people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's still a predominant amount of the population here in Ontario. And that article found that 30% of people do not have access to stroke rehab services. Like, those services are more than 4 hours away.
Oh, my 30%
of people live more than 4 hours away from stroke rehab services.
Oh, my God.
And stroke is one of the leading causes of death in Canada. And it's the third leading cause of death and leading cause of adult disability. And you're telling me that people in Ontario don't have access to those services?
Right? It's not like, again, like what you said, it's not third world countries. It is third world countries too, but it's also countries like Canada. Yeah. And, like, specifically provinces like Ontario, where these issues, these disparities are quite prevalent.
Yeah, going that topic that you're saying of, experiencing health outcomes that are quote-unquote from third world or developing countries.
Yeah.
That's even experienced here in Hamilton. There was an article, this article, by the way, was shared to me by our pal, Isabella. Isabella, you're listening to this? Thank you. I'll see if you actually end up listening to this, if you let me know. Yeah, she shared with me this article entitled A Five Alarm Fire. And this was a report published by The Spectator. So it's a news publication source here in Hamilton that looked at health inequity and health disparities within the city. And on the topic of experiencing, like, health disparities that are equivalent to third world countries, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. So let me read it here verbatim. 10 years ago, the gap in lifespan between the highest and lowest Hamilton neighborhoods was 21 years. Now it's grown to a gap of 23 years. From a highest of 87.7 years to a shocking 64.8 years. So that's saying, just to reiterate, that the highest income neighborhoods currently, those people living in those neighborhoods live an average of 23 years longer than the people coming from low-income neighborhoods.
That's so bad.
And that number, yes, it is very bad. And that, according to this article, that number is lower than that lifespan is lower than the struggling African nations of such as Malawi.
Oh, so that the gap is even bigger.
Like, it's saying that, like, that lifespan is equivalent from,
It's equivalent.
Like, it's not far off from the lifespan of people living in countries like Malawi.
Like, from the lowest income.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's kind of, like, it's quite shocking because, like, 20 years, like, you might be like, okay, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But taking the fact, like, we will be turning 21 this year. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot. Like, if you were to reflect back on your life in that 21, that's a lot of life to live.
Like, just going back to that, like, that's a prime example of how your postal code, your socioeconomic status, your racial background, and your gender, your sexual orientation, all these factors come into play when determining health outcomes. Not even overseas, not even in some, like, third world country or, you know, quote-unquote developing nation.
But 20 minutes away.
20 minutes away.
It kind of just shows, like you said, it. These disparities, like, they don't happen overseas. They happen, like, you know, in backyard.
Looking back on this, it was sounding...
Like a very negative podcast.
Yeah, really.
But we should really end it on, like, a positive note.
Okay. Right? Not to minimize anything.
Yeah, definitely not. But, you know, you have to show the negative to show what potential positive steps we could take next.
Sure, yeah.
But I think our biggest question is here, like, who do we hold accountable for this inequity that is prevalent in the healthcare system? Doctors, nurses, politicians, policymakers?
I think it's... Is this a rhetorical question or for me?
I mean, if you want to answer it, go ahead. But if you... It's a very hard... Like, you can't really pinpoint it. But if you have an opinion, go for it.
Yeah, just in my opinion, I guess, it's something that everyone has a responsibility for.
Mm-hmm.
Some certain factors are influenced by, systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
And things that have been set by previous governments that enable health inequities and disparities in health to be perpetuated in society.
Definitely.
But it's also a matter of doing what you can to promote community engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So by that I mean, like, getting involved within your community to learn about the disparities in health that are impacting your neighbors. And doing what you can, I guess, to...
Staying informed, kind of.
To stay informed.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's something so simple, but truly, like, giving a damn about health
Yeah.
goes a long way.
It really does.
What do you think, by the way?
I think that was great. I think it, again, like you were saying, like everyone plays a part in this, right? Just because it might not affect you in the way that has affected other individuals doesn't mean you can't use your privilege or your resources to stay informed and help educate others maybe, or help, again, create community engagements and where we could help individuals that do not have the same resources.
Yeah, and by helping, it's not in a cynical or, like, meant to be a negative thing.
No, definitely
not. It's just, like, why wouldn't you want to be engaged and help improve your quality of life, but also the quality of life of others?
Yeah, you gotta be a team player.
It's a team player. When you thrive,
everyone thrives.
Everyone thrives. Everyone goes to McDonald's. But going back, when you thrive and when your community thrives, everyone thrives.
Yeah.
Not just from a health standpoint, but economic, government.
Definitely.
Social justice standpoint.
I think that's a great way. I think this is a great way to end the podcast.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for being here, Janini.
Did I have a
Did you have a choice? <I'm kidding.
laughs> No, I am glad that we could have this conversation today.
Awesome, I am too. And I hope you guys learned something as well.
You guys can't see me, but I'm
giving two thumbs up.
Yeah. Thank you, dudes.
All right. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.